Hello, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the course. I'm glad I have my, I can see my slides here so I know what course I'm giving. Before I start the lecture, I'll just say a little bit about the mechanics of the course. The course consists of 6 lectures. I usually lecture for about an hour, and then in the half hour that's left, that will be time for questions and discussions, objections, arguments, that sort of thing. And there's also there's weekly quizzes. I try to make the quiz fairly easy, I don't give trick questions or anything nasty like that. Some people like to do that, but that's a bit sadistic, so I don't do that. So the quiz will just help you see if you get the main points of lecture. Now, one thing I should say about this course, this is a history course, so the way I do things in this course is a bit different from the way I do it in philosophy classes. Some of you have been kind enough to take some of my classes on libertarian ethics or other philosophy courses. So in a history course, as opposed to philosophy, we're concerned with particular events, particular people who've done various things. And in my own work in history, and although most of my work now is in philosophy, I was trained as a historian, I emphasize a lot of details. I agree with the 19th century French historian Jules Michelet that history is a resurrection of the flesh. We're trying to bring back what has happened in the past. So I tend to give a lot of names and dates. And don't worry, you don't have to know all of these or remember all these. I'm just giving them to kind of give you a sense of what was going on. But I just want to warn you in advance that I do tend to give a lot of names and dates. So if you're used to the arguments from my philosophy class, you'll find this is a little different. Now, I gave this lecture titled The War Between the States. So the question comes up, why did I call the war between the states rather than the Civil War, which is the most usual name for it? Now, you may know that the war between the states is the way the war was referred to in the Confederate States, and the partisans of the Confederacy down to our own day call it that. But the reason I chose this name, I called it this name, isn't that I'm a Southern partisan. I'm not a member of the Triple K or anything like that. It isn't that I'm an advocate of the South, but I think it's a more accurate designation for the war than the Civil War. Why is that? Well, in a civil war is a war to take over the government of the country. Say if you had the English Civil War in the 17th century, you know, remember the war between King Charles the First and the forces who were revolting against him, the Cavaliers against the Roundhead. What they were battling for would be who would take over the government of England. The people wanted to overthrow King Charles. It wasn't that the people who were rebelling against the king wanted to have a particular part of England to be broken off from the rest of England where they would rule. Rather, it was they wanted to take over the whole thing. And this is characteristic of the Civil War. For example, in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, there was a revolt against the Spanish Republican government by the right-wing forces under General Franco. And again, what they were trying to do was take over the whole country. And the American Civil War, as it's often called, wasn't like that, because what the Southern states wanted to do was to form an independent confederacy, an independent association of states, the Confederate states in America. It wasn't that they said they wanted to overthrow the U.S. government. It wasn't that they said, well, we're not happy about the election of Abraham Lincoln. Of course, they weren't. So we want to put in our own president. We want to make Jefferson Davis the president of the United States. No, that wasn't what they were doing. What they said was, we want to break off from the United States and set up our own government. So that's why I don't think it should really be called, as the war should be really called, a civil war. Now, regardless of what you call it, one of the most important facts to realize is that the war resulted in over 600,000 military deaths, that's counting the deaths on both sides, an unknown number of civilian deaths. And except for World War II, this was the most of any American war, so it was a very big disaster for America that this war took place. There were many more people killed in the war between the states than there were, say, for example, in World War I. And it was, of the various wars in the 19th century in Europe and elsewhere, this war was the bloodiest one. People, in Germany, when they were building up the Prussian army, people studied the war between states. They studied the military tactics. This was the bloodiest war of the 19th century. And it had very bad effects on the people. Now, before the war, I see misspelled Southern here. The Southern per capita income, the income per person, was about 80% of a Northern per capita income. So there, the Southern income is less than the Northern income before the war per capita income, but it's not that far away from it. But after the war, after 1865, it was only 40% of a Northern income. So they're really, the Southerners were really far inferior in income after the war to the North because the war devastated their states. It really knocked them out. And it took about 100 years after 1865 before they reached this 80% level again. So you can see the war really had a devastating effect. Now, given the immense costs of the war, all the deaths and the bad effect on the economy, the question naturally comes up, could it have been avoided? Now, some people, it's a very popular opinion nowadays, say, well, this is very sad that all these people died in the war, but didn't we have to have a war to end slavery? After all, the Southerners weren't going to give up slavery voluntarily, so it wasn't necessary to force them to do so. It was up to them if they could have, if they wanted to end slavery, maybe they could have peacefully, but they just wouldn't do it. But if we look at some other examples, the British in the 1830s were able to end slavery in the West Indies simply by buying off the planters. And if this had been attempted with the Southern slave owners, if people just said, well, we'll buy them off, we'll just raise enough money to pay them off, according to the Harvard economist Robert Barrow, this would have been less costly than the cost of the war. And of course, there have been many people killed. Now, you might say, well, why would the Southerners have sold this, that they agreed to take the payment? The answer there, presumably, if they offered them enough money, they would. It wasn't the case that slavery was enormously more profitable than other lines of work, because you can see there's an economic reason for that. When someone sells the slave, the owners, the ones who were selling the slaves originally, would estimate all the extra gains that the people would get, extra gains more than the standard rate of profit. So So once you bought a slave, you wouldn't really be earning more than you would with free labor, because you would have had to pay all the costs to the one who sold you the slave. So the only people who really profited from the slavery more than in the average profits were in the issue, the ones who sold the slaves in the first place. So it would seem that if you bought off the slave owners, you'd be able to do it. And we can look at there is slavery was abolished peacefully in various countries in the 19th century. For example, in Brazil, slavery was ended peacefully. In Russia, the serfdom, which wasn't full slavery, was somewhat like it was abolished by Tsar Alexander II, or I think around 1861. So it could be done. It isn't just an idea. People have to say, well, we could just end slavery peacefully. It isn't just a pipe dream people come up with. It was actually done in various countries around the world. Now, I want to give you a couple of verdicts before getting into the details of how the war came about. I give you some verdicts on the war. One is by economist Robert Barrow, who's generally not an Austrian economist, but he's generally a free market economist. I find him a very interesting writer. He says that Lincoln, remember Lincoln, of course, was the president of the United States who really directed the war between the states, that he said he presided over the biggest error in American history. And Lord Acton, who was the great British classical liberal historian, said in a letter to Robert E. Lee in November 1866, he said, this is, I think, one of the most important quotations we can give on the war. He said, without presuming to decide the purely legal question, which it seems to me evident from Madison and Hamilton's paper, the fathers of the Constitution were not agreed. But what he means by that, the purely legal question, is whether states have the right to secede under the Constitution. So he thinks that people aren't, the founders weren't really agreed on this. They're saying, without presuming to decide this purely legal question, I saw in state rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and secession filled me with hope, not as the destruction, as the redemption of democracy. So what Acton is saying is, really, the secessionists were acting in the cause of liberty because they were acting against the strong central government. Now you might say, well, what about slavery? Aren't they favoring slavery? But as we'll see later, the war wasn't started to abolish slavery. So Acton is saying the secessionists were really on the side of liberty. And he continues, he said, this is continuing the quotation from Acton, the institutions of your republic have not exercised on the old world the salutary and liberating influence which ought to belong to them by reason of those defects and abuses of principle which the Confederate Constitution expressly and wisely calculated to remedy. So he thinks the Confederate Constitution was better than the U.S. Constitution. I believe that the example of that great reform in the Confederate Constitution would have blessed all the races of mankind by establishing true freedom, purge of the native dangers and disorders of the Republic. And then concluding the quotation, the institutions of your Republic have not, therefore, I deem that you were fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization. And I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond. That's when the Confederate Army surrendered to the Union Army. I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo. Of course, Waterloo was the defeat of Napoleon. So he says that he thought the loss of the Confederacy was a bigger blow to victory over Napoleon. I'm not saying he was right, although he makes a strong, I think he has a strong case, but I'm just giving this kind of a preliminary to show how one of this very eminent classical liberal viewed the war. And now let's go on to the next slide. Why isn't that moving? Ah, here we go. Now, I think in understanding how the war started, we have to consider what we mean by the United States. We talk about the United States, the country. Now, we tend to think of the United States as a single country, say like France or Spain. The United States is just what the country where many of us, I don't know, there are people, various people from around the world, I think, who are listening to this course, but say, though, for those of us who are American, well, we're part of the United States, just like citizens of France are part of France, or Spanish citizens are part of that country. So this wasn't the dominant view in the pre-1865 period. At that time, the United States was a plural expression, states more than one state, and people would refer instead of to these United States. So it wasn't that they would say the United States is, that you wouldn't say we'd say today the United States is the leading military power in the world. There they would say these United States are the leading military power in the world. Of course, when people talk about these United States, they weren't the leading military power, but they would refer to the United States in the plural. And it just is another example of how people didn't view the United States as kind of a unitary country the way we do today. You would rarely see the American flag. You would just usually see it if you were on a ship that had a part of the U.S. Navy or commercial vessel that had the U.S. flag, but you would rarely see the flag. Of course, they didn't have a flag salute till the 1890s, but you wouldn't really see an American flag around. And to go a little more deeply, when we talk about the state as in the United States, the state didn't mean as it does an administrative division of a country. So we say there's the federal government and divided into the U.S. is divided into various administrative divisions like California, New York. The state was a synonym for a government. So people would say France or Spain or the Netherlands was a state. So the United States was somewhat like an alliance or union of various independent governments. It's something like, say, the European Union today, just as there, of course, is a movement for European unity, but people who are in the European Union today, most of them probably view themselves as citizens of a particular state. They don't say, well, we're European, but they say we're French people or British or German. So it's quite similar to that time, in at least many people thought of the United States as simply an alliance of various independent governments. And under the Articles of Confederation, which joined the states together before the Constitution, remember the Constitution was Constitutional Convention met in 1787, it was ratified in 1789, but before that, the United States was under the Articles of Confederation. The states were sovereign, that means they had full authority over over their affairs, just like just like independent nations. So, in they, of course, they had certain powers they expressly delegated to the general government. And this feature was retained in the Constitution of 1787. except for powers that were delegated to the central government, these were sometimes very important powers, the states retained their sovereignty under this new government. So again, what the Constitution established was not a unified nation in the way we think of that today. In 1798, in the famous Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, these were responses to the Alien Sedition Act of 1798. Jefferson, of course, Thomas Jefferson, remember the author of the Declaration of Independence, and James Madison, who was the father of the Constitution, is called the one who most influential person writing the Constitution. Both of these were presidents of the United States. They claimed in 1798 that states could nullify laws they thought were unconstitutional. As they supposedly, the federal government passes a law that a particular state says we don't think it's unconstitutional, then according to them, they could simply say this law doesn't apply in our state. So again, I'm just pointing this out just to show how different the things were in the early days from the way we think of a nation today. Now, there were some people, say, when Danny was saying don't phone in, it reminds me of the story, I think I told this in my other class, what's the best thing to do if you get ringing sensations in your ears? And the answer is get an unlisted head. Okay, so continuing with, I was talking about nullification. Some people, such as Jefferson, went further and say that a state can nullify a law that it thinks is unconstitutional. They thought that a state could withdraw from the union. They said a state could say, well, you know, we just don't like the way things are going, so we're withdrawing, just like say countries that are allied can decide we don't want to be allied with you anymore. Jefferson thought that a state could do that as well. This isn't implied, well, I see Robert said, with get an unlisted head, that was the joke. Okay, so this isn't implied by nullification. Somebody could hold consistently a state can nullify a law that it thinks is unconstitutional, but it doesn't imply that a state can leave. So, and also it doesn't go the other way. If you accept secession, oh boy, I've really messed up here. It's secession, not succession. I don't know, my head wasn't working too well when I did these notes. I'm sorry. So if you accept secession, it doesn't imply you have to accept nullification either. Somebody could say, well, the state can leave if it doesn't like the way things are going, but while it's in, it doesn't have to, in the union, can't nullify law. So the two are two doctrines, nullification and right of secession, are logically independent. They usually went together. Now, states' rights were especially emphasized in the South, but not exclusively there, because the Southern states were very anxious to ensure that their social system, which included slavery, wouldn't be interfered with, it would remain intact. Now, there was a contrasting position to this, one that the union consists really of independent sovereignty that can withdraw. It was this contrasting position was more popular in the North than the South. And according to this other view, this held the United States with much more like an ordinary nation, the Jeffersonians believed. And some of the people who supported this were Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of Treasury, very influential person in American history. Tom DiLorenzo has an excellent book on him. And Joseph Story, who was a famous justice of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court who wrote commentaries on the Constitution, and most of the time Daniel Webster, who was a very influential senator. What these people said was, once the state ratified the Constitution, once the state had said, yes, we accept the Constitution, then the state couldn't change its mind about being a union, couldn't leave without the consent of the other states. So there's a contrasting view, you see. Now, there is a basic difference in the economy between the North and the South, and this led to a very important difference in policy. The South depended primarily on agriculture. If people in the South wanted to purchase industrial products, they would naturally want to get these products as cheaply as possible, so it favored free trade. You can see why they would favor that, because supposing there were protected tariffs that were imposed to protect northern industry, then the Southerners would have to pay for more expensive American product. If you didn't have a protective tariff, then the European goods could, under some cases, undersell the Americans, so they'd save money. And then also, if you had American tariffs, this would increase the chances that other countries would retaliate and put tariffs on American goods. And this would put Southern exports in danger. The Southern economy depended on revenue from exports, especially from cotton, exports of cotton. So they didn't want tariffs because this would make things bad for them. They were very much against that. Now, in the North, on the other hand, as I mentioned before, many of those favored protective tariffs. They thought, well, this is going to help American industry. And the Southern states didn't like this as a state because they'd have to pay for more expensive northern products. And one view that was prominent in many of the northern states was very, it's called the American system. This is especially important in promoting tariffs. The main point of this American system, which is supposed to be a way of unifying the American people, were really three main points: was high tariffs, a national bank, and internal improvement. Internal improvement means what they call today building infrastructure, that kind of a catchphrase. President Obama used that all the time. Says he always said we've got to build infrastructure, things like roads and bridges and those railroads. That would all be considered internal improvement. And the people who supported this view of the American system were called the Whig Party. And Henry Clay was one of the main people in that who supported that. He was from Kentucky, which was a border state, but the American system was more popular in the North than in the South. Interestingly, one person who for a while supported the American system was John C. Calhoun, who later became the most important theorist of the Southern secessionists. But at one time, Calhoun was a proponent of this American system, then he changed his mind later on. Now, in example of how we can connect what we said so far, first I started talking about how certain people, especially in the South, thought of the states as having quite a bit of independence, that America isn't just a unified nation like other countries, but it's more like an alliance of independent sovereignty. And then I started talking about the difference in economy between the North and South, where the South was more agriculturally favored free trade. So these come together in 1832 because South Carolina nullified the tariffs of 1828 and 1832. I shouldn't have said secessionists, although, because they were later secessionists, but here they're just nullifying it. These are people who later, the South Carolina people later became secessionists, but here they're not seceding, they're just nullifying these tariffs. They're saying these tariffs are too high, we don't want these tariffs. So they not only don't we want them, but they won't apply in this state, we won't let you collect them in South Carolina. As we'll see, this played a crucial role in the onset of the war between the states, the same thing, where they're not, this is the South Carolina saying, you can't collect the tariffs here. Now, Andrew Jackson, who was the president at the time, he was pretty much in the Jeffersonian tradition. He wasn't generally opposed to states' rights, but he rejected nullification. He said states don't have the right to nullify laws they think are unconstitutional. And Congress passed the Force Bill authorizing use of military force to collect the tariff. But then at the same time, Congress lowered the tariff in 1833, so South Carolina withdrew its ordinance of secession. They had said they were going, ordinance of nullification. I keep making this mistake. I must be something wrong with me. I don't know what it was. I'm sure people in the class would have very good answers to what's wrong with me. I suppose I'm a bit senile. But I meant should be ordinance of nullification. They said, we're not going to, since you lowered the tariff, we withdraw the nullification. So then there was no attempt to force them to to collect the tariff. They said they're going to follow it. So it's not clear which side really won out. At least Jackson said, we're not going to accept nullification, but on the other hand, Congress lowered the tariff. Okay, so now on to the next slide. Didn't change yet, but here we go. Now, we now get to one of the most important issues in the whole pre-war period, slavery. Now, slavery had been abolished in the states that were north of the Mason-Dixon line. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Mason-Dixon line. This is Mason-Dixon line is the boundary between Pennsylvania and Delaware on the one hand, and Maryland and Virginia plus West Virginia. West Virginia didn't become a separate state till the war between the states. At that time, it was all part of Virginia. So there's this kind of boundary between the North and the South. So in states that were north of this line, slavery had been abolished by 1804. And in the southern states, on the other hand, slavery became more entrenched after the invention of the cotton gin. People before the invention of cotton gin in the South were saying, well, slavery's a bad thing, but maybe we'll eventually be able to get rid of it. But slavery became more pronounced after the cotton gin was invented as Eli Whitney used to say, get your cotton picking hands off my gin. Prolonged laughter at that, and that was supposed to be a joke. Okay, so slavery, find slavery in the southern states, not in the northern states. And not only was it the case that there was people in the north didn't have slavery, but there was a widespread abolitionist movement. There were people, I think, they were very right to say that not only do we not have slavery ourselves, but slavery's immoral institution, we shouldn't enslave other people. This is, contradicts morality, goes against the principle of Declaration of Independence. We don't want it. So in the southern states, there was a great deal of resentment of the abolitionist movement. They said these abolitionists are trying to interfere with what they call their peculiar institution. So I see Mark said, how is slavery abolished? Well, just by legislation, people in the state said. Now, except for the abolitionists, the North didn't favor, in general, the total suppression of slavery. What the dominant opinion in the North was that they wanted to exclude slavery from new territories that the U.S. acquired. Remember, the the United States was gradually expanding across the American continent, and the dominant opinion in the North was they didn't want to have slavery in these new territories. Now, why was this? Well, kind of your first thought, they say, well, we think slavery is wrong and immoral, so we don't want it. But that wasn't the real motive, although there were people who favored it. Yes, that's right, secession instead of succession. That's right, that was an error on one of the slides. So a main reason that people in the North didn't want slavery in the in territories, well, they just didn't want blacks there. They said, well, we don't want even free blacks in these territories, because the aim was they wanted to help free white labor. They said America is a country for white people. At times, most people have what we consider today very racist view. They said, we don't want these people, these blacks belong in Africa. We don't want them here. So that's why we don't want slavery. This is a nation for white people. And this was actually an attitude that Abraham Lincoln held. He said, we don't, ideally blacks should be colonized elsewhere. And the blacks really don't belong in this country. So because of this conflict over slavery, this led to a passage of a bill in 1820 that prohibited slavery in the former Louisiana Territory. Remember, this is Louisiana, remember, famous Louisiana Purchase under Thomas Jefferson, quite a great deal of territory. So this prohibited slavery north of a certain line, which is 3630. So north of that line, there would be no slavery except for Missouri, and south of that line, you could have slavery. So under this, it was called the Missouri Compromise. Under this compromise, Maine was admitted as a free state, Missouri as a slave state. So the southern states were very anxious that people didn't start admitting a whole lot of free states, because then they thought, well, Southerners said, well, we have a certain influence over the U.S. government as it now is. We can make sure that the government doesn't put in measures that will attack our institutions, but if we keep putting in a lot of free states and not balance them by slave states, then we're going to be just outvoted on things. So they were very anxious not to have too many free states in. Okay, now, next slide. Just waiting for the transition here. It didn't shift yet. What's going on here? Let's try again. I want my next slide. Ah, here we go. Now, the conflict over the extension of slavery in the territories got worse after there were efforts to pass what was called the Wilmot Proviso in 1846. Remember, in 1846, the U.S. was involved in a war with Mexico. That would have been a very interesting war to lecture about. The reason I didn't is, well, we only have six lectures, so I had to start the course before then, but there was a war under the administration of President Polk that led to acquisition of a great deal of territory from Mexico. So the Wilmot Proviso, which was introduced by a representative from Maine, said that no slavery would be allowed in any territory acquired in the Mexican War. Naturally, the Southern people in Congress and Senate didn't like this, and the Wilmot Proviso didn't pass, but it created a great deal of, it added to this hostility between the North and South over slavery. Now, this crisis over this conflict over extension of slavery in the territory was somewhat relieved by the Compromise of 1850. Now, the Compromise of 1850 was a series of, I think there are five different bills in this. And this was Stephen A. Douglas, who was a famous senator from Illinois who debated Lincoln. Remember the famous Lincoln-Douglas debate of 1858? He was the main person behind the Compromise of 1850. So this was trying to satisfy everybody, both in North and South. So Compromise allowed the admission of California as a free state, but it made provision for possible slave states in Utah and New Mexico, although those states really weren't suitable for the kind of agricultural labor where you could make use of slavery, but that was part of the Compromise. And it also put in a tougher Fugitive Slave Act. Now remember, in the Constitution, there's a provision that if, say, slaves tried to escape by going to a free state, of slavery, slaves, of course, were very happy about being slaves, and they sometimes tried to escape. So the provision in the Constitution said they have to be returned to their former owners if the former owner demands, and they can't just say, well, you know, we want them to be free here in this state, they have to give them up. So in the Compromise of 1850, there was a tougher Fugitive Slave Act. Okay, now, these slides aren't shifting as fast as I'd like. Don't know why that is. They're obstacles on the road to progress. Let's try again. Now, one thing is interesting to point out that a lot of people, I think it's a very important point in considering the origin of the war between the states, that secession wasn't something that people just had the idea in 1860. People had the idea before then. There were secessionists in 1850 and 1851. People said, well, this Compromise of 1850 isn't really doing enough. We want to get out of the Union. And people such as Robert Barnwell Rhett in South Carolina, William Yancey in Alabama, Edmund Ruffin in Virginia, these were called the Fire Eaters. And they said, well, we think the Union really isn't in our interest and we want to get out. So a lot of people will say, think of the Union kind of as a default position, but if you don't think of it that way, I think you can understand the war a little better. There were people who thought being in the United States was a mistake, and in 1850 they were defeated, but they were really around, they didn't go away. Now, one thing we sometimes have to get kind of counterfactual is, what would have happened if there had been secession in 1851, 1861? Well, it might have been, this is something we can't prove, but might have been they have a better chance of success in 1861 because the disparity in economic growth between the North and the South wasn't as great as it became in 1861. It was much less in 1851, so they might have been successful in seceding from the Union. Okay, now, we had even more trouble. The Compromise of 1850 really didn't settle things, because in 1854, there was the Kansas-Nebraska Act. This was sponsored by Stephen A. Douglas, remember the person who had favored the main negotiator of the Compromise of 1850. And the Kansas-Nebraska Act allowed people in the Kansas and Nebraska territory to decide from themselves whether to allow slavery. So Stephen A. Douglas, kind of an ultimate Democrat, he said, well, if you want slavery, it should be up to the people themselves to decide in the territory. So he didn't believe in people had certain natural rights. He said to Douglas, well, look, even if the majority wants slavery, this is taking away people's rights. He didn't hold that view. He said people in these territories should decide for themselves whether to allow slavery. So by passing that, that repealed the Missouri Compromise, because these territories were north of the line, the 36-30 line, the Missouri Compromise established. The Missouri Compromise said no slavery north of the line 36-30, except for Missouri. Kansas-Nebraska Act was repealing that. And because the Act said that it would be up to the people to decide in this territory, decide, this led, particularly in Kansas, for groups of both people who were against slavery and slave owners to rush into the territory so they could get the majority, and it led to armed conflict between them. It's called, as we get the expression, Bloody Kansas from the Kansas-Nebraska. Now, there's another very important event that happened. It's kind of, remember what we're doing now, we're really trying to show how this tension really screwed, this kind of tension was really become more and more screwed up before the crisis of 1860. In 1857, in the famous Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court ruled in, it was a 7-2 decision, that all the justices, I think, wrote opinions on all nine justices, but the majority opinion written by Chief Justice Roger Taney was from Maryland. He ruled that Negroes, even if free, they were free Negroes, of course not all blacks were slaves, he said they could never become U.S. citizens. No black could become a U.S. citizen. And it also, he also ruled the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. I mean, the Missouri Compromise said there can't be slavery north of this particular line. And what Taney said was Congress had no power to prohibit slave owners from bringing their slaves into federal territory. He said slaves are property, and the Congress doesn't have the power to restrict slave owners from bringing their property into a federal territory. So this decision wasn't accepted by people who didn't like slavery. They said, we're not going to, such as Abraham Lincoln, they didn't accept this Dred Scott decision. They said, well, this could apply to this particular case, but we don't accept it. And the Republican Party, this is the ancestor of the present Republican Party, been formed in 1856 as an anti-slavery party. So this is the party that says we're against slavery, so they're founding this party to attack slavery. In 1860, they nominated Abraham Lincoln as their candidate for president. Now, Lincoln, you probably think of, you remember the story, born in a log camp, and he would portray himself as kind of coming from a very poor background, which he did, but at the time he was a very wealthy railroad lawyer. He wasn't poor by any means. Now, the Democratic Party, which was the main opposition party, split. Stephen A. Douglas was the candidate of one party that would become the National Democratic Party, but there were some of the Southern Democrats didn't think Douglas was a firm champion of what they wanted. They thought Douglas was saying, well, people should be able to vote slavery, either in favor or against slavery, so they thought that didn't go far enough. So they favored another candidate, Breckinridge. And then there was another person went to the race, Bell, who was part of the Constitutional Union Party. He said the most important thing, we have to compromise to preserve the Union. So you had a four-way race for president, had Lincoln, Douglas, Breckinridge, and Bell. And Lincoln was elected. He got the most electoral votes, even though he wasn't on the ballot in much of the states. I think in 10 of the 7 states, he wasn't on the ballot. So we have this anti-slavery person is elected president. Now, here, Lincoln, we should understand, although he was against slavery, he was not an abolitionist. He wasn't someone who said, well, I'm going to just go in and get rid of slavery in this country. He thought he had no constitutional power to interfere with slavery in the states. He said, well, I don't like slavery. I think it's wrong, but the Constitution doesn't give me the power to interfere with slavery. And he even favored the Corwin Amendment, which was proposed in 1860. That would have entrenched slavery permanently. That would have put into the Constitution the provision that slavery could never be upset. So but Lincoln was a very strong nationalist. He thought he wanted to preserve the Union. He was against slavery personally. He thought the most important thing is to preserve the Union. And he would be willing to accept an amendment that would keep slavery permanent in the states where it was if that would be needed to preserve the Union. Now, he was opposed, though, to slavery in the territory. He said slavery, he didn't want slavery extended anywhere where it wasn't already present. And although, as I mentioned before, although he opposed all slavery, he didn't believe that blacks should have political rights in the U.S., and he favored settling them in colonies abroad. Now, Eric Foner, who's an influential historian today, said, well, Lincoln really changed this policy toward the end of the war between states, but then he was more sympathetic to giving blacks political rights. But it appears, in more later research, Lincoln remained in favor of colonization. So he really thought America is a white person's country. He would be qualified as a racist today. And most important thing to remember about Lincoln's policy, he was a follower of Henry Clay, and he favored this American system. Remember the American system, high tariffs, banking, national banking, internal improvement. And in his inaugural address, he made clear that he would collect the tariff at all costs, said to the founding states, well, I'm not going to use force against you, even though you have no right to secede, but I will go in and ensure that the tariff is collected. So this was very important to him, that he wanted to collect the tariff. Now, after Lincoln's election, but before his inauguration, March 1861, remember that time, we had the election just like now, we have the election in November, but the president didn't take office in January the way they do now. The president took office in March. Can anyone tell me, who was the first U.S. president who took office in January and not in March? Does anybody know that? Any case of that? Who was the first president who took office in January? It was Franklin Roosevelt in his, Mike says not me, probably not. No, it was Franklin Roosevelt in his second term. So question would come up, I said Lincoln didn't want to end slavery in the states, so why did the southern states secede? You know, they don't want people to interfere with their institutions, but Lincoln said he's not going to do that, so whether they didn't believe him, but I don't think that's it. It was that they feared that there were Republicans more radical than Lincoln, like Thaddeus Stevens, who was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives, and Charles Sumner, who was the senator from Massachusetts, who was extremely violent in his rhetoric. In fact, he'd gotten so violent that his anti-Southern rhetoric that one representative, Southern representative, Preston Brooks, came in and caned him, hit him over the head with a cane and beat him unconscious. So the Southerners were afraid, well, if they stay in the Union under Lincoln, then these radical Republicans will really take action against them. And they, we think that, you know, we usually think when we talk about the radical Republicans, we think of them as after the war. These were people who were in charge of Reconstruction. They were present during the war, and they very often got into conflict with Lincoln. And also, the Southern states were afraid that the North would try to impose high tariffs. They feared that in 1857, the Tariff Act that was passed was fairly low, but they feared that if they remained in the Union, then the Congress would pass a higher tariff, which would go act against them. And one thing also remember, at, it's important to remember, at the time that we think of Lincoln now as the most important person, at the time he was elected, he wasn't the dominant person in the Republican Party. They had other people like Seward, who was the Secretary of State, who was very influential. And so it wasn't that people said, well, Lincoln, it wasn't when we're thinking, why did the Southern states speed? It wasn't just a reaction. What they thought about Lincoln was a reaction to various people in the Republican Party. Now, as I mentioned, tariffs were extremely important. So and the war began when Lincoln tried to reinforce the garrison at Fort Sumter. The Charleston Harbor was one of the main places in the South where tariffs would be collected, and this garrison at Fort Sumter was there that would protect efforts to collect the tariff. And Lincoln knew that when he reinforced the garrison, this would probably provoke an attack, but he did it anyway. And so after the fort surrendered, Lincoln called for a national army to suppress the rebellion, four more states to feed. Now, Martin said, which four states? Well, I think Virginia was one of them. I'd have to look up all the others, but Virginia was one that seceded afterwards. So they thought that Lincoln had no constitutional power to call up such an army on his own. So a key thing to remember is that the war was not fought to end slavery. Lincoln, as I said, was a strong nationalist. He said in a once in a letter to Horace Greeley, the famous New York editor, that if freeing all the slaves would help him win the war, he would do that. If freeing none of them would, then he would free none of them. It would be whatever he thought was needed to save the Union, he would do. But he decided in September 1862 issued the Emancipation Proclamation, and by doing that, this helped turn the war into an ideological conflict, and so after that, they could portray the war as a battle between the forces of good who were opposed to slavery and the evil slave owners. But it was the Emancipation Proclamation was adopted as a military measure, saying to the Southerners, look, if you don't rejoin the Union, we're going to confiscate your property. So it was kind of considered kind of an extreme measure. And Lincoln favored, as I say, was an unconditional supporter of the strong nation, just like Bismarck, who was a near contemporary in Germany. Remember, Bismarck had unified the various German states in the war against Denmark, 1864, Austria-Hungary, 1866, and France in 1870-71. Prussia had been in all these three wars, and Bismarck had created a unified German state. So Lincoln similarly said he doesn't want these states to see him as one nation, and he favored a total war policy. Prior to that, in West Point, the American Military Academy, the soldiers have been taught kind of a restrained type of war, which would be avoiding damage to civilians. General George McClellan was one of the early commanders in the war who favored that, but Lincoln opposed that and got rid of McClellan. He said he wants kind of total war. That's anything, we need to do anything we can to preserve the Union. Now, I'm out of time, but I just want to say a little bit about various shifts since 1865 in the interpretation of the war. Now, the most popular opinion about the war today is it was a struggle between good and evil. People say, well, the North was fighting to end slavery and the South was trying to preserve and extend it. So the Northerners are the good people and the Southerners are the bad people. In this view, the war, the Holy Crusade, was prominent during the war itself. Remember the Battle of Hymn of the Republic, through the War of Howe, and kind of a very religious theme, were doing the work of the Lord in fighting. Now, after the war and after the end of Reconstruction, 1876, this interpretation of kind of a war as a struggle tended to fade out, and there was a mood of national reconciliation. But well, we had this tremendous war, we were quarreling, but now we're all part of the same nation. For example, Woodrow Wilson, who besides being president of the U.S., and we'll be talking about Wilson a lot in the lecture on World War I, he was also a historian and political scientist. He said in his book, A History of the American People, that both sides were acting on what they thought was right. So he was saying, well, they had a difference of opinion, but both sides were doing what they thought was the right thing. Now, before World War II, the dominant view was a little different from Wilson. Wilson said both sides were acting what they thought was right. But the dominant view before World War II was that both sides had made mistakes. And in this view, the war could have been avoided had it not been for extremists on both sides. And Stephen A. Douglas, remember the one who was compromised in 1850, one who debated Lincoln in 1858, he went up in the popular estimation because they said, well, he was someone who might have been able to preserve the Union because he believed in compromise. There were very influential historians such as James G. Randall, Avery Craven, who said that the war had come about by a series of mistakes. So they said, there wasn't an irrepressible conflict. This was a phrase that was used by Lincoln Secretary of State William Henry Seward in his speech in 1858. He said, because of the existence of slavery, there was an irrepressible conflict, a conflict that couldn't be stopped between the North and the South. So historians such as Randall and Craven said, no, this view is wrong. We could have stopped the war just by trying to compromise. Now, after World War II, historians tended to shift to this moral struggle position. And then again, just as they had during the war, they saw the war as a conflict between good and evil. Now, why was there this change? Well, World War II was seen as a struggle against evil. It said, well, America's fighting to prevent Hitler from taking over. Hitler, of course, was an extremely evil person. We're fighting against Japanese imperialism. So this fight in World War II, I put World War III here, I'm anticipating a little. So there were influential historians such as Kenneth Stamp and Berkeley and the political theorist Henry Jaffa were affected by their World War II experiences. They lived through the war. And Jaffa is still around. He's in his 90s, but he was around. He was around in World War II. So they were very influenced by their experience in World War II in considering the war between the states. And another influence interpretation of the war after World War II. After World War II, especially in the 1950s and 1960s, the civil rights movement flourished. Remember, this is the movement because the blacks didn't have political rights and voting rights and various other things or discriminated against. There's a movement to give them where they fought for their rights. So people tended to view the war as a precursor to the civil rights movement. The people who supported that movement tended to stress the struggle to end slavery, even though, remember, the war wasn't actually fought to end slavery, but people tended to look at the war from the perspective of civil rights movement. And one last thing I mentioned, kind of, I think kind of an interesting one, the Communist Party played an important role in promoting this interpretation of the war as a struggle between the good Northerners and the bad Southerners. Karl Marx himself viewed the war as an assault by the slave pump. I'm amazed at the number of typos in my slide. I don't know what was the matter with me. Maybe I should be enslaved myself. But I say Marx viewed the war as an assault by the slave power against the unions of the South or the aggressors. And communist influence historians like Eric Foner continued this interpretation to the present day. So these are some of the things that have influenced contemporary opinion on the war. Well, at this point, I think we'll have the rest of time for questions and objections. I'm going to shift to the Q&A box, and if you have a question, just type it in there, or if you've done it already, I'll try to respond. I hope you don't give me ones I can't answer. That wouldn't make me look good. So we'll see what happens. Okay. Now I see you restart. Now we have Justin says, I remember a politician in response to Ron Paul mentioning the possibility of buying slaves freedom from owners, claiming that Lincoln did try to pay off the plantation owners, but they refused. He did not elaborate. Do you know what he was referring to? Well, I think there was at the time Lincoln was had in, did consider for a while some proposal like that, but nothing really came of it. By that time, in 1860, or the conflict had reached such a point, there was so much bitterness that wasn't really practicable. The suggestion that Barrow was making that this could have been done somewhat earlier, but at that time the tensions had gotten to such a point that I don't think it would have probably not possible. Now Brian asks, why do you think South Carolina was most aggressive of all the Southern states towards secession? well, I don't think there's any deep-seated reason for it. One of the factors was that John C. Calhoun, I didn't talk about him much in the lecture, but he was the main theorist of the view that the Constitution had to preserve Southern interests. He favored a view where he said, well, you should have what he called concurrent majorities, where legislation should not just have to be passed by the majority, but by all the different interests in the country. So the Southerners would be able to veto any laws that went against them. And he was from South Carolina, so I think he was very influential. But I think it just turned out that many of the secessionist theorists happened to live there. So I don't think there's any deep-seated reason for it. It's just the way it turned out. Okay, now Lou asked, why did so many Northerners actually go physically into battle in the South? Was it just for the pay? Did they think the war would be mostly be bluff and bluster quickly over? Well, I think actually there were many people and who thought, who responded to Lincoln's appeal for the Union. There were many people in the North who thought that the Southerners do not have the right to secede. Say, if you look at President biased against them, but many people in the North said, well, we want to be one country. They don't have the right to do it. And especially when the Southern forces fired on the forces at Fort Sumter, even though I think no one was deliberately killed. I think somebody might have been accidentally killed, but there were no extensive casualties. People were very upset at this in the North. And later on, there were some people in the North who did have the idea of once we had the Emancipation Proclamation, some of the soldiers felt they were fighting against slavery. And of course, later, blacks were admitted into the Union Army, and they were, of course, very anxious. They wanted to be, they were fighting to help preserve it, to end slavery. And also, one further fact, there were a lot of immigrants, especially German immigrants, who were in the Union Army. So they thought this was a good opportunity for them. So they thought that that was one reason they got into the war. So they were willing to go into battle. I don't think it would be primarily for the pay, because they didn't get paid all that much. Now, Rudy asked, why did the South not get more support of Europe given their favored free trade? Well, one reason was that the British government was some kind of, there were some people in the British government who did favor supporting the South, principally for that reason, but they were somewhat afraid of getting into a conflict with the American government. They didn't want a conflict. And also there were forces in England who were very sympathetic to the North, such as some of the workers that were in Manchester and other parts of Lancashire were very sympathetic to the North, with people like John Stuart Mill, great classical liberal who was very pro-Northern. There was a big split in British opinion, so they weren't able, the British really didn't want to intervene. There were remember the French did use the war for a while to try to intervene in Mexico, and this got them into a lot of trouble with Lincoln. Now, Ivan says, why were the Fire Eaters called the Fire Eaters? Well, just because they had kind of very fierce rhetoric, like you have the expression, somebody's breathing fire. It's just because they were considered kind of very violent in what they said, violent in the extreme. Now, Chris says, how is it the invention of the cotton gin further entrenched slavery? Well, when you had the cotton gin, it enabled it very much increased demand for cotton, because cotton could then be processed in a much more rapid way. So you could then, it would be profitable to have plantations where you have a lot of slaves working. Before that, it wasn't so profitable. People had maybe a few slaves working for them, but now with the cotton gin, it became profitable to have very large plantations with a lot of slaves. Now, Peter says, I'd rather slavery on its way out, but on its way out by 1850, especially in the northern part of the South. Is this true? Well, there's some evidence for that. That's actually disputed. Some people say that it was pretty successful. There was a book by Fogel and Engerman who said it was pretty successful. But, if you look at a contemporary book I call The Slave Power, I'll just put this down. This is a book written in the 19th century. If I didn't send this, wait, I'll put this, send. I didn't do this right. Wait a sec. Okay, try this. This message isn't I don't know why this message isn't working here. Oh, I didn't put it in the right place. I'm sorry. Let's try this again. Wait, let's try it here. Okay, went to the chat room. I see. Okay, so he was a great classical economist in the 19th century, so he said that free labor is more productive than slave labor, so slavery would be on the way out. I think that's Mises thought very highly of Kim. Tony has had the South develop any natural resources of their own before 1850, coal, mineral, etc., was it mostly all agriculture? I think agriculture was the predominant one. There were other things, but it was primarily agriculture. I have to look up exactly on the other point, but it was primarily agriculture. Now, Anthony says, before the Civil War, with the United States compared to what the European Union is now in terms of union, how is it the same and or different? Well, that's a very good way, I think I mentioned that in the lecture, a very good way of looking at the union. The way it's different is that not everybody would have accepted that way of looking at it. That would be a view that would have been prominent in the Southern states, but they were nationalists and said, no, we have a stronger union than that. It isn't just the Confederacy. But that was a very prominent view. And so then I think there's a great deal of historical evidence for that view, but not everyone at the time accepted it. Now, Ray asked, why did England allow the blockade of southern ports? Well, they really didn't like it, but under international law, unless they were to recognize the independence of the Confederacy, recognize them as an independent nation, under international law, the government in power had the right to do that. And if they had recognized the Confederacy and independence, it might have involved them in a possible war with the U.S., and they didn't want to risk that. Now, Rudy said, according to Wikipedia, the American death toll in World War II is 418,500, which would make the war between states not the bloodiest, not the second bloodiest. Well, I think that's a good, but if you take account civilian casualties, it would put the World War II figure higher. But I wasn't just considering military death, but if you take civilian casualties, I think it would be higher for World War II, but it was certainly up there. Zachary said, in regard to Lord Acton's letter, what were the strengths of the Confederacy Constitution as opposed to the U.S. Constitution? Well, I think the Confederacy Constitution, there's a good book on this by Marshall DeRosa, I'll put him down. I think it didn't allow protective tariffs, and I think it more explicitly guaranteed, it said that the powers of the states, and it said that powers not expressly delegated or retained by the state. You don't have expressly delegated in the 10th Amendment. It would be pretty clear that the role of the states was made much clearer in the Confederate Constitution than in the U.S. Constitution. Peter says, how did slavery end in Europe and South America? Well, Britain, it was really ended by legislation, also judicial decision. There was a famous case that by the British Chief Justice Lord Mansfield, that if you brought anyone into England, that would automatically make them free. In South America, again, it was ended primarily by legislation. Now, Brian said, whether actual mustard recolonized the slaves after afterlife is just rhetoric. Well, there were societies like the American Colonization Society who were trying to promote that, and they were trying to, there were some blacks who were interested in it, but they were never able to get a lot of people going. Liberia was founded, you know, the African country of Liberia was founded as a, for colonized American blacks, it was American blacks who founded that, so that would be one example of colonization. Now, Ivan said, Hamilton and Webster believed that a state, once it joined the Union by ratifying the Constitution, could only write and secede from the Union with consent of the other state. But how many states had to give consent? All of them, a majority of them. Well, that's a very good question. They weren't really, they didn't really say exactly. I think Lincoln took the view that the majority would have to agree to this, but that wasn't really specified. So the main thing they said, it was just like, once you've signed a certain contract, you just can't get out of it by yourself. They say, if I've signed a contract with you to do certain things, I can't say, well, I don't like it anymore, I'm out. And then the opposite, Lincoln refers to this view in his first inaugural. He says, look, you can't, you say it's a contract, I don't accept that, but if you do view the Union as a contract, you can't get out. Now, if you took the view, though, that the Union is something like a treaty between independent states, then they could get out. They generally can in international law and nations that say, well, we don't want this treaty anymore, and they can just say, we don't, we're not going to follow it. They didn't, unless he says, what position did Cobden and Bright take on the war? I think they were, I'd have to look this up to be sure. I think they were fairly sympathetic to the northern side. David says, what was the main reason the Southern states left the Union? Why? Because Lincoln was elected president. Well, no, as I tried to say in my lecture, they were afraid of the radical Republicans would try to do things to them, and they also didn't like the possibility of high tariffs. And they just didn't think the Union was such a good idea for them. They, you know, we think, well, you really need a big reason to get out of the Union, but we don't have to view the war that way. If we just say, well, why should they have stayed in? They just didn't think it was a good deal for them. But it wasn't, so I don't think primarily fear of Lincoln is a fear of people, the Republican Party, various people in it generally. Graham says, did not in the real tariff, but you expanded the number of items that were included under the tariff, whose rate went from 20 to 36%, pose a significant reason for many of the southern states to secede. By the way, this tariff was passed before Lincoln's, well, but remember, it was passed only after some of the southern states had seceded. They wouldn't have been able to pass it if the southern states hadn't seceded. So that wasn't the dominant thing that got them to secede, although it might have had some effect on the four that left after the firing on Fort Sumter. But they were afraid that there would be tariffs like that, but I don't think this particularly, if you thought this particular tariff would cause recession, that would be more backwards causation. Now, Ivan says, what if hypothetically more states decided to secede and stay in the Union? Would they still be required to seek consent, according to people like Hamilton and Webster? Well, I don't think that's a possibility they explicitly considered. I would think in that case it would be kind of a general recognition that the Union wasn't working, so things would just kind of dissolve automatically. I don't think that's a possibility they were really thinking about. Now, Lou says the technical sophistication of the Industrial Revolution greatly increased the structure of capacity of weapons used. Was the North perhaps terrified of anything less than annihilation, the invitation to a great risk of revenge? Well, I don't think so. I mean, that's a possibility, but I rather doubt that. I think it would, because if they had reached some compromise settlement, then the southern side wouldn't be fighting anymore. So I don't think that's really what they wanted. It's just they wanted to make sure that they just wanted to make sure the Southerners wouldn't have the power to secede again. And the radical Republicans went at this point, once they started on this very tough policy, they wanted to make sure that they kind of to crush the South and impose their own designs on them. So I doubt that they were afraid of a risk of revenge, although it's an interesting suggestion, but I haven't really seen that canvassed in the literature on the subject. Why didn't Jackson said, why didn't Missouri secede? Well, there were different forces there. I mean, they were both pro and anti-slavery, and I mean, I think Lincoln just put in sufficient Union troops to prevent them. Now, of Anthony's question, the same question I answered before on how the European Union is saying they're different. I think I gave answered that one already. Now, Matt says, I've heard the argument the U.S. government could have avoided the war by pushing, but while I agree it would have been preferable to a war such as Russia, isn't using tax dollars to free day in conflict with libertarian ethics? well, I suppose that's an interesting point. I suppose it is, but I mean, then you could have, I suppose, raised the money privately to free them. I mean, why would it have to go through the government? That's an interesting point. But presumably, if there's money taken in taxes, it comes from the people anyway, so they could probably have done it without going through the government. Now, Chris, as we know how Lincoln is idolized by many, is one of our best presidents, we know better that what did people think of Lincoln as president today? Well, there was a big difference of opinion. There were, especially after his assassination, were some people who did look at him very in an idealized way, but he had a lot of people who didn't like him. You know, when he gave the Gettysburg Address, 1863, it didn't attract, some people really didn't pay all that much attention to it. Remember, can anyone tell me who was the main speaker of the Gettysburg battlefield at which Lincoln gave a Gettysburg Address? Does anyone know that? Automatic A, if anyone gives me the answer. It was Edward Everett, who had been Secretary of State, who gave a very long oration. Lincoln was attacked. Many people said, one of them was called the Ugly Ape, and people would make fun of him and attack him. So he was much more controversial than he is now. Now, Connor says, when did the Republican Party become so popular in the South? I know the South didn't like the Republican Party for a long time after the Civil War, but it seemed like there's been a huge change in opinion nowadays. Well, this was primarily under Richard Nixon in 1968. It was called the Southern Strategy, where the Republicans were appealing to Southern conservatives. And it was continued under Reagan, so it's a fairly recent development. Now, Matt says, what were some of the traditional restraints in the war that Lincoln rejected? Well, say you couldn't have do things that would endanger civilians, or say, such as burning, say, Sherman would burn various cities in the March, the siege. You really couldn't. You had to. The war would be primarily just between the opposing armies, and you couldn't destroy the crops or the land of the people you were fighting with. And now Ray says, were there private groups buying freedom for individual slaves? Yes, there were some. There wasn't extensive, but there were such things. Now Tony says, was there any infamous aggression between states before the Civil War? I'd have to check that, but not on any extensive amount. Well, we're a few more questions. We're running out of time now. Graham says, was it named the Republicans and their industrial supporters used a tariff to transfer the wealth of the South to the North? people in northern states could spend other people's wealth on internal improvement and, in effect, increase their power. Yes, I think they did do that. Yes, that's one of the things the South objected to. We're paying most of the tariffs, but it's going to help you northerners. You Yankees are getting the benefit of this, but we're paying for it. Now, Peter says, why the draft ensued the war and desertion was increasing. Yes, the draft was put in during the war. Now, Anthony said, do you think the Lincoln turning the war into an ideological one was then for pragmatic geographical reasons, considering the concentration of the state still condoning slavery? It seems that even some of the northern states could oppose tariffs. Well, I think, he thought that that would be a way of kind of forcing, it would really be hitting the southerners in the pocketbook to say, well, we're going to confiscate your property if you're slaves, if you stay in rebellion. So it's kind of a very forceful measure against them. Brian says, how do you think Lincoln's second term would have progressed if he wasn't assassinated? Was there any major legislation or? Well, I think the main thing was he wasn't a radical Republican, so he wouldn't have had a very as radical a program as was actually put in Reconstruction. And the story about Murray Rothbard, Leslie says, getting up in the middle of the night saying that blank, 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 he lived in Whitney, didn't invent the cotton gin. Yes, he did say that, although later he changed his mind and thought they had. But he did say that. He said that to his wife, but he actually took the view that Whitney did invent the cotton gin, which is just the temporary view. Joel said, in what way were the Republicans radical, were increased tariffs a primary concern of the early seceding state? Well, they were radical in that they didn't have much regard for states' rights. They thought that they could really have kind of a federal law imposed on the South. They were willing to put in military government and overthrow the Southern legislatures after the war to put in what they wanted. And were increased tariffs the primary concern of the early seceding states? I would say it was a concern. I wouldn't say necessarily the primary one, but it was perhaps the primary concern of many of those in the North who wanted to prevent secession because they wanted to collect the tariffs. Well, I guess we're out of time now. So thanks very much for coming to my lecture, and hope we'll see you all again next week. Thanks very much, everybody. Thank you.